The world is a frightening place. How are we to navigate the perils that lurk out there? Well, the British Army has some advice for its soldiers. The first thing the soldiers are told to look out for is the absence of normal, i.e. the sudden disappearance of children or women or traffic from the streets. Those things that should be there suddenly not being there. The second phenomenon they are warned to be vigilant about is the presence of abnormal, meaning the abrupt appearance of things that shouldn't be there suddenly being there. Unfamiliar pickup trucks, hard-faced men in black robes showing up on street corners trying to look like itinerant balloon sellers. Or perhaps a woman sitting outside her own home but unable to enter it.
I wasn't even born when the events of Paris 68, Les Vaumont, happened. Wouldn't be born for another 12 years. But strangely enough, I know all about them. See, there was this art teacher at school. You know, people say, oh, there was this one teacher at school who really inspired me. Well, he wasn't that. He was just some frazzled old lefty, and the only interesting thing about him, the only compelling thing he'd ever done, was he'd actually been in Paris in 1968. So he never shut up about it. The riots, the street theatre, the fact that he'd been beaten up by the CRS, the slogans on the wall, be realistic, demand the impossible, la poésie est dans la rue. Poetry is in the streets. Mostly, he would talk about the Situationists. The Situationists were these Marxist surrealists, and their slogan on a wall was beneath the pavement, the beach. They had all these ideas about reclaiming the city, which they called psychogeography. Psychogeography focuses on the city, but not the fancy stuff, not the museums and swanky restaurants and opera houses. Rather, it's the place around the back of the opera house where they put out the bins, or overgrown traffic islands, or strange little parks. The Situationists said you should become lost in the city, which you achieved through the derive or drift. Psychogeographers idolised the romantic stroller, the flaneur, who wandered about the streets with no clear purpose other than to wander. Of course, there's a thin line between a flaneur and some idiot who's just got lost. That's why I bought a flat in central London, because I had this idea that I would wander the city streets finding inspiration and illumination. Except I didn't. I don't. I drive everywhere. I suppose, although he was an arse, the art teacher's words stuck with me because that's what I thought I'd become. Some kind of artist. But then when I was 13, my dad got sick, and it was terrible to see this big man who'd been my protector, my rock, suddenly shrunken and white with pain. My mum was no use, she just ran around screaming. And at that same point, well, I decided I didn't want to be an artist anymore. I buckled down at school, where before I'd been a bit of a troublemaker. And I went to university and studied law, and now I work as the youngest partner in a big city law firm. It's not a big passion, but I've never regretted following that path, and I'm really good at it. People do sometimes ask me, do I have something else I wish I'd followed instead of law? There is an artist in our street, not one of the big ones, not a shark pickler or anything. You've probably never heard of him, but still, he can afford a whole Georgian house. I mean, who'd have thought you could make so much money from art? This is a very nice area as it goes. The pavements are always clean. There's a private square opposite. Considering how close we are to the centre of London, it's fairly quiet here. Well, except when it's not. But it's nice here. It was only when I reached the front door and slipped my hand into my coat pocket that I discovered that I must have left my front door keys inside when I went to work in the morning. Oh. So I'm sitting in my car, outside my house, with almost 3 hours to kill before my husband comes home. I think about getting the laptop out and working on some case notes. Then I think about making a couple of work calls on the mobile. Then I think about not doing either of those things. I think about, for once, just relaxing. Just sitting there and watching the world go by. So, I'm sitting in the car, the heater's on, and I'm looking around at the other houses. And it occurs to me that this is the first time I've ever really spent any time actually looking at the street where I live. Normally, all I ever do is step out of my front door, cross the pavement to my car or an Uber, or go to the corner to hail a taxi. It's weird. I've lived in this street for nearly 10 years without ever looking at it for more than a few seconds. So what do I see when I look? A long row of elegant four-storey early Victorian townhouses, and facing them a large private square with plane trees reaching up higher than the houses. Beyond that, the outline of more trees, because even though this is the very centre of London, a brisk 15-minute walk to the West End, bizarrely, our street is on the irregular edge of several acres of grass and woodland. The garden square backs onto a children's playground complex, playing fields with tall London plane trees and bushes, and beyond that, the council park. Monty used to go into the park, our cat. I'm sure he must have done. In fact, Monty was the only member of the household who knew the area well. He was an unneutered tomcat. I'd had him since he was a kitten. Every night, Monty'd wake up from his place behind the broadband hop. Then he'd squawk to be let out the window and swagger off towards the square. The last I ever saw of him was his ball swinging as he disappeared into the shadows. Then the next day he didn't come back. I'd always sort of imagined Monty was indestructible. I thought he was so wise and so smart that he'd always be able to avoid any car wheels or wild dogs that came his way. But apparently not. That was a year ago now. Anyway, the reason we chose the house wasn't for its rus in ubere charms. Rather, it was because of its proximity to the law courts. My offices are in Bedford Row, which is only a 5-minute drive away. The barristers I need to see are in the Inns of Court, which start at Gray's Inn, which is literally at the end of our street. And my libel cases are heard in the law courts themselves on the Strand. In a way, the whole area is like a legal shopping mall. You must think it's nuts to drive such short distances, but my car's a Tesla, so that's all right. Our place is two houses, which have been converted into 5 flats. They're all occupied by several brands of lawyer. I've met the other lawyers in my building, although we're not really what people call neighbourly. We say hello if we happen to bump into each other on the stairway. Well, that's about it. As for the neighbours in the other houses, not a clue. I haven't met any of them apart from maybe one or two. I've never been one for mixing with people next door, nipping in and out of each other's houses to borrow jam. I'd rather go without jam. I have friends. Not lots, but some. They're scattered across London in ones and twos. It's funny, I'm always reading about these great roiling extended families that apparently everyone has nowadays. In reality, most of my socialising tended to be with people from work, and I didn't even like that much. Once or twice a week, there'd be some kind of drinks do, in the British fashion, which means no food apart from stale nuts, and the non-alcoholic option is a gin and tonic, and everyone would get hammered. Except I didn't drink. I despised drunks. The lack of control appalled me. I thought, what could there be inside your mind that is so bad you have to scour it with alcohol? I still think about Monty a lot.
Every day, really.
I checked the time. Adam be part there 18 minutes. That sounds like a decent length of time, but it isn't. It's just 18 minutes. There's so much time to kill. I think I might try another nap. It's so warm in the car with the heater on, so I close my eyes and snuggle down into the seat. The instant I do this, I hear a car zooming up, playing this, well, noise. I mean, it's a residential area, not some drill music drag strip. So I watch this car park up, and I recognise it immediately. It's a red Vauxhall Astra. It has a huge blue disabled badge in the window. Never seen the owner before. Well, this young man literally jumps out of the car. Good looking guy. He's wearing sports gear and he's dancing, dancing like he can still hear the music, dancing like he's in a club. And he dances right across the road, really going for it. I can only assume he's still on some high from some drug he's been taking. Coke or ketamine or moo cow or whatever it's currently considered fashionable to kill your brain cells with. Anyway, he's still dancing and he's heading for this house 3 doors along from us. Suddenly, he does a front flip. Seriously, lands it perfectly. Right in front of the door, slips his key in the lock and dances inside. Disabled my arse. Then it's quiet again. I open the window a little to get some air and I hear this extraordinary sound I've never noticed before. The roar of rushing water, and it's coming from a cast iron manhole cover in the middle of the road. And then I remember this woman I met, a neighbour, started talking to me in the supermarket, who said she'd noticed me and we lived in the same street. So I asked her which house she lived in and she said Sir Abdul Ali Khan. I thought at first it was one of those gender things you can't challenge anybody on anymore. And though she looked like a 60-year-old female academic type, she had chosen to identify some sort of Muslim potentate. But it turned out she was referring to the blue plaque on her house. Sir Abdul Ali Khan, Muslim scholar and poet. We don't have one, but there's hundreds of them in the street, writers, artists, politicians who lived and sometimes died in these houses. I don't think there's ever been one on our house that says, Catherine, adequate lawyer. But she'd written this book on the history of the neighbourhood, had Sir Abdul Ali Khan / timid academic woman. And in it, she writes about all these local rivers and streams, tributaries of the Fleet and the Tyburn that crisscrossed the neighbourhood and once ran above ground, full of fish and reeds and wading birds, but now are confined to culverts under the street. I thought of these black currants beneath our houses, and it made me feel sort of strange. There's all these psychogeographer writers like Ian Sinclair, who walked right round the M25, Will Self and Peter Aykroyd, who wrote some creepy books about London. He used to have his office in the street. And when he tottered past to go to the corner to hail a taxi, I'd hold Monty up to the window and say to him, "There he is, that's Peter Aykroyd." He did this remarkable thing, Peter Aykroyd. He had a heart attack or something, but he said he wasn't going to let it change the way he lived his life in any way. He wouldn't stop drinking or smoking, lose weight or take more exercise. I can't imagine that, not making every effort to keep yourself safe from harm. Anyway, he doesn't come by anymore. I don't know whether that's because he's moved his office or he's lying in a coma somewhere. His mind, dark, like one of those rivers. I'd been there for about an hour and a half when I saw these two youths walking along the pavement, coming towards the car. They were laughing and joking, mucking about. One of them kept pushing the other. It was friendly but rough, if you know what I mean. They were probably only about 15, but tall, wearing black hoodies and tracksuit bottoms. They made me feel, a bit unnerved. It made me wonder, you know, casting my mind back to when I was 15. Did my friends and I cause adults to be unnerved when we were wandering the streets laughing and joking? I doubt it. Anyway, I was watching them and they came to a halt a few feet away from the car. I knew they hadn't spotted me. One of them was talking on his mobile and the other was texting on his phone or playing Pokey Monsters or whatever it is they do. There was something about their manner, I don't know what it was, but I could tell they were up to no good. I just knew it was something to do with drugs. Either they were selling drugs or buying drugs or asking someone about drugs or telling someone about drugs or something drug-related. It was so obvious. I thought it might be a good idea to report them to the police. I mean, at the very least, they were loitering. And the law is quite clear about loitering. See, I thought if I could get a photo of them loitering, that could be used as supporting evidence. So, I got my phone and I took a couple of photos of them. But then, when I looked, they were so grainy you could hardly make them out at all. It was a dark night and they were wearing these black hoodies, which, if you think about it, is quite suspicious in itself. So I took another photo, but the bloody flash went off, of course. That made them notice me. Suddenly, the two of them were staring right into the car, right at me. I didn't know what to do. I was just frozen. Then I thought, sod it, I'm phoning the police right now. So, I press 99. Then the screen goes completely black. The battery just dies. I tap the screen once more and lift it to my ear. I'm making it look like I'm phoning the police. Tapping the screen three times and pushing it to my ear. If they're watching closely, these lads will know that I'm phoning 999. So after a moment, I say, please, please. I didn't say it too loud, but I say it just clearly enough for them to hear. All this time, they're both still standing, staring at me. So then I start saying, I'm parked on Montague Court, London, and I'm witnessing a drug deal. But as I'm saying this, they both nod to each other, turn their backs and drop their trousers, which are only half covering their underpants. Anyway, then they pull their underpants down as well. So I'm sitting there trying to improvise a one-sided conversation with a non-existent police receptionist while being faced with two spotty teenage backsides. This isn't my typical Thursday. I managed to come up with a few more lines about how I would continue to monitor the situation until the police turned up. But the whole time I'm being stirred down by these arses. The moment seems to go on and on. I closed my eyes, and when I opened them, they were still there. Then suddenly they both burst out laughing, pull up their tracksuit buttons and wander off. I wouldn't say that I feel violated, but actually, I do. I do feel violated. I didn't think my street was like this. I guess I don't know this area as well as I thought I did. The next 30 minutes or so passed calmly enough, but somehow my mind won't settle. My perception of where I live has started to shift. Before this evening, I'd been the centre of my own universe. But now I'm developing an uncomfortable awareness of the other lives that are going on around me. Sleeping when I sleep. Breathing in and out in a rhythm along with my own. The cosy, warm feeling I had earlier has disappeared. Now I desperately want Stephen to come back and let me into the sanctuary of my own home. I somehow don't feel safe. I begin to wonder if all the work I've been doing is preying on my mind. Or maybe it's some kind of karma. After all, a big part of my job is to ruin other people's days. I suppose I'm quite dedicated to my work. Those distinctive long brown envelopes I send out. A size and shape that nobody else in the world uses. So when one of those drops through your letterbox, you know you're in trouble right there. As soon as someone sees one of those letters on their doormat, They know their day is ruined. Perhaps I have to pay a price for all those long brown envelopes. About 9:30, I noticed two swarthy young men exit the house next door but one. They're accompanied by a very pretty young girl. About 15 years old, I'd guess. She's beautiful. The sort of girl men can't help staring at. Tall, blonde hair, big eyes, lovely face, lips, great figure, but very natural, you know? Not all fillers and lip plumpers and boob jobs. She's just very naturally beautiful. A whole life ahead of her. Again, it makes me think about when I was 15, 16, how anxious and critical I was about my appearance, how I absolutely hated so many things about the way I looked. But now, when I see photographs of me then, all I see is this beautiful and vital young girl with a whole life ahead of her. Something tells me I'm destined to be in my 70s, looking at photographs of me in my 40s, thinking how vital and beautiful and young I look. I just wish I could see that right now. Anyway, I'm watching this beautiful young girl coming out of number 66, accompanied by these two young guys. So the three of them cross over the road and they're standing by this red sports car just in front of me. It makes me uneasy, though. I mean, what exactly is the relationship between the girl and the man? I mean, is one of them her boyfriend? Or are they in some way in control of her? Has she been trafficked? Is that possible? Again, I think about when I was 15, how terribly vulnerable I would have felt in that situation. It's now 10 o'clock. I can't believe how quiet the street is. Despite this, or maybe because of this, I'm feeling, well, I'm feeling unsettled. It's so weird. I'm sitting in my own car, on my own street, outside my own house, and I feel uncomfortable. Vulnerable, I suppose. It's also different to how I imagined it to be. It's like I've spent all these years living somewhere I know absolutely nothing about. All I know for sure is what the inside of my apartment is like. Everything else feels... I don't know. Alien. I never realised it before. But every morning when I step out of my front door, I enter a completely unknown space. I don't know any of the people. I don't know what they do or how they operate. Suddenly, looking up at the empty street, I see a movement from the private square. A black shape opening the gate that requires a special hard copy key. The shape is a man. A tall, red-headed man wearing thick glasses. He seems to have some sort of belt with strange objects dangling from it. I instinctively know something is very wrong. The man passes close by the car before disappearing into a house three doors down. My mind is reeling. Those things jiggling on his belt. I think they were heads of cats. My heart is pounding against my chest. Heavy and hard, like it's trying to get out. I can't believe what I've seen. It's so horrible, but so fleeting. But I know what I saw. And you see, part of me wants to run up to his door, hammer on it and challenge him. But then the biggest part of me wants to drive away. Drive as far away from him as I can. Drive as far away from the street as I can. I'm breathing so fast, I'm starting to hyperventilate. I'm looking for a bag to breathe into or anything to slow my heart rate and calm me down. Oh, I wish I still smoked. I check the car doors are definitely locked. Seconds later, I check again. I'm so unnerved. My mind won't settle. I can't believe I actually let myself fall asleep earlier. Allowed myself to be so vulnerable. It takes about 10 minutes for me to get back on top of my panic. But as soon as my breathing is back to normal, I start crying. I'm thinking about Monty. Is that what happened to my cat? Was he cornered in the communal garden by the cat man? Did he end his life wiggling on the belt of that weird man? Dear God, I'm sitting there and my mind is reeling. I thought I lived somewhere quiet and respectful and safe. But all my preconceptions have been blown away by these few brief hours spent watching life go on around me. I've spent my whole life trying to be safe. By the time Stephen arrives home on the dot of 11, I've become a nervous, panicking mess. He tries to soothe and calm me down, but I refuse to listen to his soothing words. I tell him we need to move house. We need to get away from this dangerous place. Under the pavement is not the beach. Under the pavement is dark soil and the bodies of dead cats and unexploded bombs. And in a bid to quell my panic, he asks me where I think I'll feel safe. And that stops me at my tracks, because suddenly I can't think of anywhere I'd ever feel safe. So anyway, my name's Catherine, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Catherine.
Locked Out starred Maxine Peake. It was written and narrated by Alexis Sale and adapted for radio by Graham Duff. The producer was Joe Nunnery. It was a BBC Studios production.